13 years ago, I saw an event which blew my young mind. It was the defeat of my hero, Hulk Hogan, at the hands of the Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania 6. This is one of the biggest nights in the history of wrestling, a champion versus champion match that the whole world had been waiting to see this. As an 8-year-old wrestling fan, I didn't know anything about the man behind the face paint. I just knew I wasn't very happy with him. As a 20-year-old CPAC attendee, I learned a great many things. I learned about a man who has strong convictions. Warrior is the only wrestler ever to have worked with Vince McMahon to retain the rights to his character's name. Warrior steadfastly believed in his right to the creation of his intellect. Warrior is a man who has spent many hours of his time studying the great thinkers of Western civilization. Thinkers like Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, Adam Smith, Russell Kirk, Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, Ayn Rand, and many more. He has used the knowledge to formulate his own views and is now seeking to bring them to college students around the world through our lecture series. And now, since I will never get this chance again, hailing from parts unknown, Warrior.
Thank you. Thank you. Get a drink of water. You can cut the music, I think. You can cut the music. Well, you'd think after 13 years, after I beat up Hulk Hogan, he would get over it, that kid. Can you all hear me? Hello. And thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here at your national conference. And I want to begin by thanking Young America's Foundation, Ron Robinson and all its staff, Melissa, for working so hard to pull this event off, and especially, as I usually do, Mr. Patrick Coyle. Patrick was brave enough, or bold enough as the case may be, to be the first one to give me an opportunity to speak to young activists like yourself. That was at CPAC 2003. And out of that opportunity, I've been able to go out to other college campuses, speak to other activists, and let me tell you that it's been awesomely inspiring. This week, you are going to be exposed to incredible conservative knowledge. Knowledge you will take back to your campuses in preparation for the activism you will do this coming fall and throughout the rest of the school year. On a personal note, aside from the conservative knowledge, enlightenment that I'm going to provide to you during my speech today, I want you to take back with you the pride you should have in being proud of yourselves for being involved, being here this week, being concerned, thinking about what's going on in the world around you. I'd like you to all give a hand to yourself right now before we even get started. And don't take that praise lightly. Accept it in its right light, because I know a little bit about inspiring and motivating people. I've been very self-motivated throughout my entire life. I built an incredible career on inspiring, motivating, and energizing people. So you'd be showing me disrespect if you didn't take it in the way that I'm giving it to you. Probably the most affectionate accolade that I can give is that it has been just as rewarding for me to go out on college campuses and speak to 200 to 300 college students as it was to perform in front of 20,000 people a night in arenas and coliseums throughout the world. That's truly how much it means to me. I want to take a second to thank C-SPAN for being here. I told my wife a couple months ago that I was going to make a personal appeal to Brian Lamb. Brian Lamb grew up in Lafayette, Indiana. I grew up exactly 26 miles from there in a town called Crawfordsville, Indiana, and my grandmother lived in Lafayette, Indiana her entire life. I never got around to doing it, but they showed up anyway. And I need to take one more second to say hello to my beautiful wife, Dana, and my two beautiful children, Indiana and Madigan Twain. I didn't find out till Friday that this was going to be taped live. And the main reason why I have to do that is because I don't want to catch a stink from my 2.5-year-old daughter, Indiana. You see, she is very familiar with the conservative movement already. In fact, she can spot a liberal at 100 yards. And she tells me, stinky liberal, Daddy. That's great. It has been a part of my thinking since I've gone out on the college campuses that I need to spend enough time to give ample background information, sort of explain who I am, what I'm about, how I came to be a conservative, how I came to go out and be a conservative activist. But what I'd like to do today, because of this special opportunity to speak to so many who are seriously dedicated at this special annual event, is I'd like to give an abbreviated version of my life history and get right into knocking around some serious ideas. The short story on having had that career you watched on the video is, I used to do that, I don't anymore. When the business became depraved and degenerate creatively, I decided that I was not going to be able to find it in myself to rationalize childish and perverted behavior by claiming I was just an actor acting. Growing up being one of my life tenets that when we do grow up, we should think and act like it. Thank you, though, for your patience and good humor in watching it. I know among such an esteemed group of learned individuals, it would be rare to find your own television stations tuned to it, right? Anyway, I'll be around all week. I know we have a bowl session this evening. You're going to help me out with that. I'm not sure exactly what that is. But feel free to ask me any personal and professional questions that you would like. And I hope that you will enjoy getting to know me as much as I know I'm going to enjoy getting to know you. Let me start with, my name is Warrior. That is not a nickname cheaply lifted from having had my sports entertainment career. It is my full legal name. It is the surname of my family, and it means something very special, serious, and important to me, and signifies the assertive, principled, and proud, and oftentimes feisty conservative philosophy of life I live by. You'll recognize that as we move along. To skip a lot of history, let me just go back about 10 years. About 10 years ago, I took my first break from my sports entertainment career in the middle of its success. And I realized when I took it, it wasn't that I was just taking a break from my sports entertainment career. It was the first time in my life, 32, 33, 34, where I was taking a break from being in pursuit of a goal. Since I was in high school and happened to stumble into the weight room one day and got launched upon this incredible journey of self-discipline, and shortly thereafter, a few weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, when I saw the changes I alone controlled in my scrawny little pathetic physique, I knew that I could make changes in my life in other ways, so I boldly said, I'm going to better my life through education. And I set my sights on pursuing a Doctor of Chiropractic degree. So from that time, when I was in high school, up until the time I took that break about 10 years ago, I was constantly in pursuit of a goal. I was around people that were goal-oriented, goal-minded, and I was in environments that were like that too. From those times, I constantly was busy all the time, focusing and concentrating on succeeding at life. Really, better said, concentrating and focusing on finding out what success was all about, because we really don't get taught that. We have to find out for ourselves. Out of that, probably about 3 or 4 months after I started my break, thinking I was going to take a much longer break, I said, look, I better get busy with doing something because I'm really bored. So I got involved in some entrepreneurial projects. One of those was a natural for me, owning a health club. I operated this health club hands-on, was there, customer service, doing all the things, trying to emphasize that the quality of your life can be improved through exercise. Being able to communicate with regular people that were working 9 to 5, had families, that were out there trying to make ends meet, was my first real opportunity to interact with people on a regular basis, get to know my neighbors, find out about their philosophies of life, hear and see how they thought about, you know, success, parenting, relationships, education, politics, thinking, and problem solving. And I got to tell you, it was a real eye-opener for me. There are two dramatic things I found out. One was that most people don't have any serious thinking that they're doing. And two, most people operate their lives by their feelings. The second thing was, as a guy who was always pursuing the highest degree of success in my own goals, I thought that everybody had the same extreme desire and passion to exceed at their own goals, no matter what their profession was. I very quickly found out I was wrong about that. Most of those I interacted with felt without any logical explanation, that success was more dependent in stepping into it or having somebody hand it to them. Enviously, they regularly bashed wealth and success, even bashed the owners of the businesses that provided them their own jobs. They were constantly devising ways to get out of work and still get paid for it, and with a straight face, believing they were owed it. Many cynically blamed the condition of society for their failures, some of them even going so far as to blame their failed personal relationships on society, as if society hadn't done enough to raise them up the ladder. They did not believe that hard work, consistency, perseverance, striving to be best at what you did, doing what you love to do, they did not believe that any of those were the keys to being successful at life. They also believed that their choices made by their own free will had little to do with where they were in their lives, their places, or their circumstances. They used feelings more than thinking to make their decisions, although if you asked them, they would say no, adding insult to injury. Most of them believed having success was associated with having money and material possessions and being able to live degenerately or corruptly without accountability. It was very clear to me these people and I had two distinctly divergent philosophies of life. Mine was built on a solid foundation of thinking and self-reliance. Theirs was built, unfortunately, as are too many others, was built on an unstable foundation of feelings and dependency. Of course, on many of these occasions, interacting with these adults, political terms would come up. But I was ignorant about politics at the time, even after all the taxes I paid. I didn't know nothing about it. I never had any exposure enough to want me to pay attention. Yet by contextual clues, I put two and two together and deduced that government or politics must have something to do with their dour life attitudes and their disconnected, illogical thinking. Because of this, I deepened my interest in what was going on in culture and politics. And I kept hearing how liberalism was an assault on Western civilization, Western culture, and Western education and enlightenment. Out of that curiosity, I crossed paths with the great books of the Western world. The great books are a collection of writings by civilization's first recorded thinkers, mankind's greatest original seekers of knowledge. In those books, I found what inspired me to steer the exact levels of energy and intensity I put into my physical pursuits to succeed in sports entertainment into intellectual pursuits. In addition, I became very fond of American history, especially the uplifting and empowering nature of the founding of this country. Again, as a guy who has professional experience portraying a hero of sorts to young minds, let me tell you that the ultimate warrior and every other human being considered a hero, fiction or nonfiction, takes a back seat to the founding people of this country. They made and broke the mold. They are the absolute heroes and should be for every American citizen. That they are not is a tragedy beyond measure. I'm not embarrassed to tell you, through the learning I've done on American history, I've discovered many things, not the least of which two of them are shame and anger. My own shame about my at one time pathetic lack of knowledge of what the idea of America meant, and my anger that America, its virtues, and the human virtues that went into creating it were not mentored to me with the discipline, reverence, and respect they deserved. At a point of about 2 or 3 years into this self-learning journey, I was having this intellectual debate with myself, using my great book knowledge, using my studies of American history, and what I was hearing from contemporary intellectualism on political and conservative issues that I was paying more attention to. And I got madder in hell about the deterioration of education in this country and the subsequent deterioration of this country overall, and I said, I got to pick up my guns and I got to get into the fight. All of it was becoming more clear to me, and with perfect timing, the woman who would become my wife walked into my life. She was conservative, and through her I realized I had been, without knowing directly, all along living by a conservative philosophy of life. I say philosophy because there is a distinction between conservative philosophy and conservative politics. Finding out and understanding I've been living by a conservative philosophy of life also, of course, opened my eyes and mind to exactly what liberalism was, and that all these people I'd been perplexed by were indeed liberals. The whining and complaining, the contradictory thinking and hope of no repercussions, the expectation that they could depend on someone to provide them not only with their sustenance for life, but the meaning of life, quality of outcome, and happiness altogether. To be blunt, I have to tell you, as a guy who spent a great part of his life building up his muscles and often being mischaracterized as a big, dumb, muscle-headed wrestler, I'm bothered and concerned, sometimes even frightened, by the lack of thinking and level of irresponsibility going on in our world, especially right here within our own borders. I made a lot of effort, but in the end, I realized it is not a simple, innocuous disparity between the philosophies of conservatism and liberalism. With even more bluntness, let me say it as it is. One philosophy is about life, the other is about death. Now I see some eyes rolling, and you may think that may be a little too radical, too extreme, a little too recent Michael Savage. But let me tell you, as a father charged with the responsibility of protecting my children from the dangers of the world and concerned for the safety and security of their own futures, I do not want my children growing up in a world run by liberalism as it exists today. Not a day passes for any of us when something uttered from a liberal's mouth doesn't make our own jaws drop and hit the floor in disbelief. I'm going to go into this in greater detail, but the short answer is life doesn't work the way liberals want it to. Instead, their view of life will ultimately lead to the end of civilization. I mean, just ask the question, what is society made up of? It's individuals, it's citizens. Our societal freedoms are only as good as its citizens practice self-restraint, decency, and law and order. Liberals have pushed the provocative envelope of human degeneracy, lawlessness, and disorder to the point that the envelope is disgracefully inside out. They scream intolerance to protect only those who are criminal or insane. They are moving our society closer and closer to an outright anarchy, completely ignorant that whether they like it or not, there will always be rules. Anarchy is but a prelude to tyranny. By liberals' kind of rules, their kind of rulers, as we can know from history, are called dictators and despots, or more fashionably by MTV standards today, thugs and gangbangers. Who in here has not envisioned, along with, of course, keeping up all your conservative optimism, that if liberalism gets away, keeps getting away with what it is, future generations will indeed manifest such rank, chaotic grossness. Liberals are chasing away the last vestiges of virtue and honor from our society, and as John Adams said, enduring liberty is the child of virtue. Thus, the society liberalism is creating is one depleted of virtue and devoid of liberty. Ideas having consequences. The consequence of tolerantly engaging ideas that have wrong, false, and evil consequences is simply destroying everything that is decent, civil, virtuous, and objective about the society we live in. That frightens me at first. Then it raises the hair on my neck, because the future picture of the deteriorated condition of this country, if liberalism, as we know it today, has its way with it, is like tossing my kids and grandkids into the fires of hell. And as long as I have the strength, I will sustain the fury to fight and work to have liberalism broken down and made impotent. Now, I'm just a guy throughout his life who has practiced a great deal of common sense, stuck with the basics. So when I wanted to find out even more about what conservatism was distinctly, what the differences were between conservatism and liberalism, I stuck with the basics. I came to some common sense conclusions. I'm here to share those with you. I found out that conservative philosophy of life I was living by before I even knew what to call it has always been common sense since the creation of this country's founding documents. I didn't have to be, and I don't have to be now, a scholar to know that. In fact, the most impressionable enlightenment about the founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, and all the ancillary communication between the founding fathers themselves, all of it put before the founding people, is that all these writings were written then in language to be understood by the common sense of the people. And yet it is uncommon to find anybody with sense enough at all able to understand them today. They were never written to be instruments. They were never written as instruments to be understood only by people with law degrees or some other sort of cryptic education. What lies therein is our conservative philosophy, America's philosophy. And if a conservative doesn't get that or have the desire to get that, then neither will common sense appeal to them. And believe me, it is common sense in its traditional sense that is the core of conservatism. The founders knew this. Ronald Reagan, one of this country's greatest modern presidents, knew this as well. So let me be serious. There's a war going on in this country. In every war, the battle leaving the greatest impression and having the greatest impact is the fundamental battle for and over the ideas. In this war, there's essentially one idea at stake. That one single idea is America. The greatest idea mankind has ever known, created by some of the greatest men, accepted and seconded by some of the greatest people who ever walked the face of this earth. Although in this country there are political identities on the fringe, the major combatants in this war are conservatism and liberalism, each one fighting to be the one driving America by their respective philosophy. I mean, let's be clear. It's vitally important to recognize here, conservatism's and liberalism's political ideas are not mechanisms of creation, creating America. They are simply mechanisms of interpretation. The founding documents already defined the idea that is America. Those documents defining America are not amorphous discombobulations of opinions that found their meaning by happenstance or mistake. It is easy for others who are not paying attention to mistake. I think that the idea of America has always been a rough draft, still after all these years under construction. What America is, it has been for over 227 years. At its core, it is to be left unchanged. Our republic form of government is already, again, as it is defined by the founding times in those documents. Taking into account all of our earnest desires to better the world, contribute beneficially to its condition, and that we are 227 years removed from the founding of this country, 215 years removed from the signing of this country's constitution, it's important toward that beneficent contribution we who call ourselves conservatives want to make, that we frequently return to our roots, reanalyze and re-enlighten ourselves to the fact that there is a difference between conservative philosophy and conservative politics. We need to take the time to look back, in effect, to ask, then remind ourselves from where do we come. Our conservative philosophy of life is conservatism's greatest attribute and weapon to use in the war battling over the idea of America. We need to understand that and never forget it. Ayn Rand, a brilliant woman who was ignorant and stupid when it came to her atheism, said this about philosophy. As a human being, you have no choice about the fact you need a philosophy. Your only choice is whether you define your philosophy by a conscious, rational, disciplined process of thought and scrupulously logical deliberation, or let your subconscious accumulate a junk heap of unwarranted conclusions, false generalizations, undefined contradictions, undigested slogans, unidentified wishes, doubts, and fears, thrown together by chance but integrated into your subconscious into a kind of mongrel philosophy, fused into a single solid weight of self-doubt, like a ball and chain in the place where your mind's wings should have grown. Philosophy is not just an abstract, high and mighty idea created by degreed philosophers only to intentionally confuse the rest of us human beings, make us think that philosophical concepts are over our head. Born, we live by a philosophy of life and come to ask during our life, what is life? What does my life have to do with what this existence is? What is the chief end of man, as Abigail Adams wondered. A question she thought, quote, every rational being, unquote, should explore. Your philosophy is your comprehensive view of life and the world around you, your view of whether or not you are capable of dealing with it, interacting with the world around you effectively, and how you come to know whether you are or not. Whatever your view is determines how you think and act within it. Government, the politics of it, doesn't mean anything without its people, the human beings who comprise it. It doesn't mean anything to the trees and the dogs who find fun in lifting their legs on them. And government won't work unless its people do. Not as in work 9 to 5 or as in remain regularly employed. Yes, that's part of it. But work in the sense that people operate their lives by an effective philosophy of life. Let's not kid ourselves. Not only do a wild majority of our fellow members of society operate their lives by a junk heap of unwarranted conclusions, et cetera, a kind of mongrel philosophy fused into a single solid weight of self-doubt, many of even our own conservative representatives don't live by or practice what is by definition a conservative philosophy of life. Many conservatives lack a conservative soul. There are many minor and major clues that reveal this. Each of us here could add to the list. We don't have the time. Two of the most blatant politically might be that, one, our republic government is just that. It is correctly called a democracy, it is correctly called a republic, not a democracy, and rarely is it properly called that. And two, our republican form of government was not designed to become a place where its elected representatives would seek and find lifetime employment. The first answer our republic representatives should give us to a question we, the people, should not even have to ask is, my prime goal is to shrink government to enlarge individual freedom. Say it like Barry Goldwater without chagrin did. I have little interest in streamlining government or making it more efficient, for I mean to reduce its size. I do not undertake to promote welfare, for I propose to extend freedom. My aim is not to pass laws, but to repeal them. It is not to inaugurate new programs, but to cancel old ones that do violence to the Constitution or that have failed their purpose, or that impose on the people an unwarranted financial burden. I will not attempt to discover whether legislation is needed before I have first determined whether it is constitutionally permissible. And if I should later be attacked for neglecting my constituents' interest, I shall reply that I was informed that their main interest is liberty, and that in that cause, I am doing the very best I can. Where are the bloody, red meat-eating conservative politicians cut of a mold like our first commander-in-chief when he said, government is not reason, it is not eloquence, it is force. Like fire, it is a dangerous servant and a fearful master. Politicians today, for a large part, unfortunately, are nasty, self-serving, sycophantic sellouts with jelly spines and mush minds. The main business of a politician, as Edmund Burke, seen as many as the father of conservatism, is still further to contract the narrowness of men's ideas, to confirm inveterate prejudices, to inflame vulgar passions, and to abet all sorts of popular absurdities. Not all, no, but sadly we live in such unprincipled times where it is easier to label them collectively than to discern who the few are, who are not. Yet, that they are, regrettably, the way they are, has more to do, much more to do, with what they don't understand or outright ignore about the Declaration of Independence philosophically than it does with their incompetence or cowardice politically. All the conservative political ideas, lower taxes, limited government, pro-life, capitalism, strong defense, right to bear arms, and the conservative-minded liberties, freedoms, and securities that conservatives want to run through all these are not concepts pulled out of thin air. They sit atop a hierarchical mass of knowledge and a philosophical base that supports them. The integrity, substance, and potential viability of any of these bigger political conservative ideas are only as good as the stability and strength of our philosophical base. And I would add, each conservative individual contributes to the stability and strength of that philosophical base only to the degree equal to the strength or weakness which he lives by a conservative philosophy of life. This country's philosophy precedes what it is politically. The Declaration of Independence is America's philosophical statement. The Constitution is America's political statement. Conservatism wants to preserve both of these, but we start with understanding and practicing the philosophy. The founders of this country knew full well that practical government application of sustaining our constitutional declaration, i.e., a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, sustaining that was only achievable if each person understood the philosophical context of our Declaration of Independence, i.e., we find these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That philosophical context was conservative then, as it has always meant. To live by a conservative philosophy of life means to favor traditional views and values and institutions, and that you have a want to conserve these traditional things, to prevent the decay, the waste, the injury to them. You want to keep them alive, continue their existence. Traditional means the modes of thought and behavior followed by a people continuously from generation to generation. Traditional does not mean, as liberalism would have the world believe, antiquated, out of style, outdated. It means simply what people have used that has worked. Certainly we can agree it is not what has not worked that people have used continuously throughout the generations. You don't keep beating your head up against the wall, doing those things that do not work, do not have effective advancing outcomes. Neither have people throughout the ages. Conservatism, conserving tradition, is nothing new. And conservatism, as Russell Kirk told us, cannot exist anywhere without reverence for dead generations. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence claiming himself that the founders and he were in exceptional ways bringing forth nothing new. In his own words, it was not the object of the Declaration of Independence with respect to our rights to find out new principles or new arguments never before thought of, not merely to say things which had never been said before, but to place before mankind the common sense of the subject in terms so plain and firm as to command their assent and justify ourselves in the independent stand we were compelled to take, neither aiming at originality of principle or sentiment, nor yet copying from any particular and previous writing. It was intended to be an expression of the American mind and to give that expression the proper tone and spirit called for by the occasion. All its authority rests then on the harmonizing sentiments of the day, whether expressed in conversation, in letters, printed essays, or in elementary books of public right, as Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, Sidney, etc. The founders were not attempting to justify a revolution on principles with which the audience, the citizenry, was unfamiliar. The idea of a natural rights political philosophy had been brewing and evolving since the first governing of man. The founders were creating nothing new out of whole cloth. They were simply acting as original conservatives, conservators of historical tradition. Taking from a knowledgeable record of thousands of years of mankind's evolution, exactly why a classic great book's education is necessary. Therein, the Declaration of Independence's philosophical statement lie not only our justification to preserve what is traditionally political, but therein lie the founders' pleas to succeeding generations are entrusted to preserve the immemorial traditions of all time. And if these things are not preserved, as the founders' caveats warned us, laced through all their prescient writings, it is not just our republican form of government that is at stake. It is the existence of all mankind. This is what is at stake. And its destiny today is in our hands, your hands. was in our preceding generation's hands. Tomorrow will be in our succeeding generation's hands. Don't fool yourselves that it is not. It will be your future family's survival at stake. If not in terms of vital signs, then in terms of quality of life. If you plan on having kids, bringing kids into the world, think about it. Look around us and see the half-life expiration-like deterioration of this country's traditions in just the last 100, 80, 40, 20, 10 years. There's an eerie irony whenever I ask a parent who's not paying attention to what's going on in D.C. with their government if they want the best for their kid. Their answer is always yes. My follow-up question is, always, are you sure? Because as much as parents want to believe they are protecting their children in their own backyards, what is going on in the backyard of our government is a horror story. No parent who truly wants the best for their family would knowingly subject their children to. Abraham Lincoln said the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of the government in the next. Only an idiot who does not belong on the street with those of us who are sane cannot see the grave degradation of damage done over just the last few generations. Make no mistake, the original conservators were telling us loud and clear, we are not only charged with preserving tradition since the founding of this country, we are charged with preserving the tradition since the beginning of time. Exactly and truly what conservatism most fundamentally is. Conservative philosophy being about preserving what's traditional, traditional being about what has worked, it is interesting to point out, while we are now preoccupied battling culturally and politically in these modern times, that the two most vintage fundamental traditions the majority of people have followed continuously throughout the ages just so happen to underscore the one thing of conservatism most assaulted by liberalism and highlight the one plain difference between conservatism and liberalism as the two are defined ideologically today. The one thing most assaulted about our conservatism is our belief in a creator. And the one thing, the one plain difference between conservatism and liberalism is thinking versus feeling, using one over the other to conduct human life and society at large. Think about it. Since the beginning of time, man has traditionally recognized there is creation. There is nothing more traditional. Creation demands that there be a creator. It and he are the primary traditions. And the most traditional thing about man alone is he thinks. He is always thinking. It is the tradition of man who has acted on his thinking that has advanced and improved mankind, not man who has acted on his feelings. Those who think make the world work, not those who feel. The fathers who founded this country declared what mankind had again for thousands of years been striving toward, to see, know, and recognize the Creator's existence as self-evident truth, one outside debate or denial, that man is endowed with incredible gifts and unalienable rights, that government must be the servant, man the master, that man is its creator. Government is not found in people created. America was founded on the understanding and acceptance of these two philosophical traditions, a country genuflecting to the first tradition, creation and its creator, a country bowing to the second tradition, the unlimited potential of the thinking free man. This is, in its most naked, pristine definition, the American philosophy of life, a philosophy conservatism wants to preserve and a philosophy liberalism wants to destroy. How many of you believe in destiny? You can participate. Raise your hands if you believe in destiny. I'm asking you. The rest of you don't? You don't. Okay. What about the other? Are the people that didn't raise their hand that believe in destiny? How many of you believe the lives of the founders is prophetic? Just a few? And the rest of you call yourselves conservatives? I'm serious. How many of you believe the deaths of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, 50 years to the day of our officially recognized independence, is divinely inspired? If you can raise your hand, raise it. How many of you believe, as George Washington stated in his first inaugural address, no people can be bound to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of men more than those of the United States. Every step by which they have advanced to the character of an independent nature seems to have been distinguished by some token of providential agency. How many people believe that? How many of you believe, as Tocqueville said about America's first immigrants, the scattering of a seed of a great people which God, with his own hands, is planting on a predestined shore? How many people in here believe that? How many of you believe what John Adams believed? America was designed by the providence for the theater, on which man was to make his true figure, on which science, virtue, liberty, happiness, and glory were to exist in peace. That America is settled with reverence and wonder as the opening of a grand scheme and design in providence for the illumination of the ignorant all over the earth. How many people believe that? How many of you believe America truly is God's country? Then you believe, as I believe, every conservative needs to believe. Thomas Jefferson penned the Declaration of Independence, and history recognizes James Madison as our father of the Constitution. And we were mindful of how all other founding people contributed. But it was the Creator himself speaking through them to us, to all of mankind. In traditional conservative fashion, it is indisputable. The Creator set mankind on a course for America since the beginning of man's time. Century after century, decade after decade of trial and error between man and the world he was created into, and in the 18th century he was ready to undertake, as John Winthrop, the first governor of Massachusetts, was first to famously declare, ready to undertake the building up of a city up on a hill, which Ronald Reagan, just over 200 years later, the glorious general that he was, upgraded to a shining city on a hill. With that in mind, we must pause and ask ourselves, just how deeply do we believe? For if we truly believe in destiny, then we as conservatives cannot believe in coincidence. It is no coincidence that thinking human beings brought mankind's evolution up into a time where profound thinking human beings were able to construct the Declaration of Independence, declaring the sovereignty of the human being's earthly supremacy. From its farthest point back in man's record of time, it has never been those who set the lowest, unthinking goals that advanced humanity. Since the days of the caveman, it wasn't the one who sat inside their shadows full of fear and feelings who brought man out of the dark caves into the light of man's future. It was the one who faced down fear and figured things out, primitively as he could even then. The history of freedom has been the history of courage and intelligence. It is no coincidence that the founders were virtuous, moral men who left us volumes and volumes, chapters and chapters, words and words of wise admonitions counseling us that our republican form of government was anchored on ballast, virtuous and moral, both public and private. Throughout all the written correspondence between the founders and within the writings put before the people toward the debate of what kind of government they would have, there is abundant and explicit observation and intimation advising the kind of character, integrity, devotion, and honor its people must have to sustain their republic. From its farthest point back in man's record of time, it has not been those absent character or those who harbored ignoble thoughts or those who practiced base acts that have advanced humanity. Vice and morality, ignorance, irreverence, stupidity, dishonesty, disrespect, ill repute, illogic have not brought us to the legitimate place where we find ourselves today. It is no coincidence that the phrases laws of nature and of nature's God and by their creator and appealing to the supreme judge of the world and with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence exist in the Declaration of Independence. Sublime is creator given. Man could never have set the highest goal for himself or humanity if it were not the highest ideal to begin with. It has always been his traditional belief that he is created in the eyes and image of the Creator that has acted as his impetus to set and shoot for the highest goals, strive to be the best he can. This country's governmental philosophy is Creator-based. It is uniquely American. No other people in history have ever made this traditional principle the basis of their governmental philosophy. To forget this truth is heinous offense against the spirit of traditional America. The Creator and man thinking are two parts of what Russell Kirk called the permanent things. America's continued existence, like mankind's continued existence throughout the ages, has always depended on these two traditions, traditions conservative-minded people have always sustained and preserved. James Madison said, before any man can be considered as a member of civil society, he must be considered as a subject of the governor of the universe. And is it not true? Mind is the measure of man as a creation. It is no coincidence that the Declaration of Independence, declaring the human being's unalienable rights, also demands a responsibility that, too, is just as unalienable. It cannot be transferred or repudiated. The Declaration of Independence points out how great we are as human beings, yes, but also clearly elucidates that the human being is fully capable of comprehending what is inescapably expected from him in return. Protection of one's unalienable rights without the assumption of self-responsibility is absurd. It is no coincidence. Benjamin Franklin famously remarked, a republic if you can keep it, and that to keep the republic, people of it must live up to their end of the deal. It is no coincidence we exist in a world of omnipresent alternatives and are created a being of free will, capable of choosing between good and evil, right and wrong, true and false. Existence is not by our design. We were not consultants devising the rules we have to live by. Knowledge of good and evil is the best fruit of the tree of knowledge. Let each one of us leave every other kind of knowledge, Socrates says at the end of the Republic, and seek and follow one thing only, to learn and discern between good and evil. With that in mind, I say to you with the utmost gravity, neither, my fellow conservatives, is it a coincidence that the thing most assaulted of our conservatism by liberalism is our belief in a creator? Nor is it a coincidence that the fundamental difference between conservatism and liberalism is thinking versus feeling. Shame on us if we are fooled into thinking that it is nothing more than a harmless, silly coincidence. We are endowed with gifts to see it for what it is, judge it for what it is, and endowed with gifts to fight against its harmful, destructive intentions and invasions on all that is traditional. And we need to. We need to do it now, and we need to do it in our lives. We should be ashamed that we are, truth be told, many times doing more to befriend a burden we will inevitably transfer to the future generations of the very ones we love than we are doing to dissolve it altogether. Liberalism, although at one time meaning man created freedom for himself by using his mind and thinking to better his life, is today at its basest, most despicable bottom line, a calculated, sophistic, and baneful assault on life as conservatism knows it, an all-out assault on the Creator and man's ability to think and provide for himself. Freedom means nothing to those who have no desire or intention to use it. Liberalism is breeding armies of hammerheads who will never need it. Success for liberalism is dependent on failure and doom and gloom. It is not liberalism's intent to win, positively achieve, positively construct anything for any of the people of America, for that matter, any of the people of the world. It is only their intent to win for liberalism as a cause, to have its cause prevail as another ism in a long line of other historically failed isms, Marxism, communism, socialism, Stalinism. Even everything liberalism has ever done with the intent of doing good, as liberalism puts it, has turned into something nastier than hell. Truth be told, the only thing ever created by liberalism is the road paved to hell with good intentions. There are no promising forks in the road on any road liberals travel ever. It is not common knowledge. Liberals believe in a utopian society where everything is equal. Nobody is or has less than anybody else, and we all have equal quantities of everything top to bottom. Life doesn't work that way. It's a good-for-nothing joke to think that it can, and an oppressive evil fraud to then try to pursue it as a goal. Like a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, a societal liberal leveling will make our society only as good as its least critical, laziest, most timid, least educated, least motivated, most beggarly, and most insipidly inspired among us. A conservative should not have to ask a fellow conservative what his response is to that. It better be, especially when you're talking to me. I don't want to live in a world like that. To hear them tell it, the failed isms of days gone by have failed simply because people didn't try hard enough, didn't sacrifice enough, didn't care enough, didn't have large enough coffers to play out the experiment to its utopian end. I'm not sorry to tell you, I don't get that. People tried so hard and sacrificed so much, the graveyards didn't have room enough for all the bodies. The philosophy of life they preach and profess, when enacted, is one of despair, destruction, and death. In every conduct, liberalism is making mankind bankrupt. And like any bankruptcy, responsibilities dumped become burdens others have to pay for. Liberals are moral relativists who think that there are no true or false, right or wrong, good or evil. I'm not sorry to tell them, with all the disrespect due, that they are mistaken, flat out. Their belief is false, their opinion is wrong, and the position they are holding is evil. Their statement that there is no true or false defeats itself just by saying it. If there were no true or false, then neither can they hold up their own. No right or wrong, no good or evil. Conservatives need to laugh till we get indignant about these two postulations spineless liberals make. They hold these reckless theories only as long as wrong or evil stays out of their own backyard. Morality is simply choosing what is right, true, and good over what is wrong, false, and evil in your life to determine the actions you will take to set the direction of the course of your life and to use when you judge others. Rather than giving up rights, literally and figuratively, we should be giving up wrongs. The more we passively acquiesce moral neutrality, the more we give up our right to free choice altogether. The only winner to come out of a compromise between right and wrong is wrong, between true and false, false, between good and evil, evil. Life does not work without morality. We are beings that pass judgment. America was founded on the fact, counting that we would. And America is a choking on moral relativity. Liberalism sees free will as a weak forever excuse that people don't really mean to do what they themselves choose to do. As a conservative, I see the constant misuse of this power and responsibility as literally spitting in the face of whatever God you believe in. It is the ultimate disrespect for your creation, the gift of your life. If I can be so bold, then I don't think anybody's going to stop me. I believe too many of us are missing something vital in the translation when it comes to the references of God, Creator, Supreme Judge of the world, and Divine Providence in the Declaration of Independence. And for that matter, the translation is skewed when it comes to all the religious references all the writings of the founding times were animated with. Our faith does not need to know the formula behind creation for us to have our belief. However, neither does our faith need to know the formula behind creation to understand our humanness. Even if the answer to it all were discovered and we could even touch it, it would not change what our humanness is required by its nature to do. We are created just as we are for the very reason to use what we are. Every other creation uses the nature of what it is. The human being is no different. Certainly, we are not beings created to not use what we are. The human being's life has never worked that way. Horace Mann said, "Be ashamed to die until you have won a victory for humanity." There is no greater victory to win for humanity than to actualize all your human potential, physically, mentally, and spiritually. Live up to the means endowed you. And this is the most lethal aid you can contribute to conservatism toward the defeat of liberalism. Of all the things you cannot control, you must control the greatest potential weapon, yourself. Conservatism has all it needs of do your best, all we can do is our best, or you did your best. These are sorry, worn-out platitudes. It is sorrier that conservatives still tolerate them. Enough already. Conservatism needs people ready and willing to actualize the entirety of their human potential. You are at an age where it is time to dedicate yourself and pick up arms, intellectual arms, self-responsibility arms, self-discipline arms. Contemporary and comfortable as these times are, I believe the classic words Thomas Paine wrote during cold, wintry days, "These are the times that try men's souls," are words better fit to today's times. Because today's times are trying truly the souls of all people more than ever. When Thomas Paine wrote those words, you can bet it was the physical pain and suffering conditions the men were subjected to that they found more trying than the pervasive degeneracy, ignorance, and literal destruction of soul that people face today. Ask yourselves, think for yourselves, and determine for yourselves. Am I going to be a summer soldier or a sunshine patriot who shrinks from the service of my country? Or will I become a full-blown warrior for conservatism, the ultimate in patriotism? Take the same dedication and determination you use to fight for the knowledge you have that there can be no compromise between freedom and government controls, that to accept just a few is to surrender the principle of inalienable rights, and that this done incrementally will swallow whole those individual rights, thus delivering us all into enslavement. Take like dedication and determination and use it to inspire yourself to an equal level of refusal to compromise conservative principles. Traditional conservatism cannot compromise on its principles. Moral treason there is treason against tradition, and treason there is no less than treason, in my mind, against America. I mean, you have to ask yourself, just exactly what kind of world do you want to raise your progeny in? Just what is it you are wanting to preserve? And how much are you willing to do to get the job done? There is nothing more destructive to conservatism than the idea one must never pass moral judgment on the thinking and acting of others, that one must be morally tolerant of anything, and that good consists of never distinguishing good from evil, right from wrong, true and false. A half-assed, middle-of-the-road, agnostic moral attitude betrays what is good, and that, my friends, is conservatism. Yes, to pronounce moral judgment is an enormous responsibility, but when you do not, you further liberalism. Today's conservative cannot fear the implications of "judge not that ye be judged." You must live to judge and be ready and unafraid to be judged. You must possess an unimpeachable character and flawless integrity. This strategy, in my mind, is the 21st century's version of what Russell Kirk called moral imagination, a warrior's full-blown version of morality. To paraphrase Barry Goldwater, extremism in the defense of moral behavior is no vice, and moderation in its pursuit is no virtue. There will always be things you cannot control. Therefore, to have the greatest impact, concentrate on those things you can. Your own conduct, your own thinking and acting is priority number one. There is no greater impact you can make than adhere to the practice. An example set is an example learned always. You must be ruthless with yourself to assert confidence in justified moral superiority and carry ruthless brazenness into speaking up in situations where your silence may be mistaken. Will you be one of those people who say there are two sides to every issue, therefore nobody is either fully right or fully wrong? Or will you be one of those who finds that that moral compromise slowly poisons the thinking and acting of humankind, brings your loved ones closer and closer to tyranny or annihilation? Will you or will you not be one who says both sides do not have equal moral authority? Will you find that the tolerance of this moral compromise feeds the irrational fantasy that there are no black and white and that people are simply unable to be wholly good, true, and right? Or will you decide on the side of truth that people are simply unwilling? Will you be one who finds the courage to be one of the willing? Douglas MacArthur said it is fatal to enter any war without the will to win it. Ask yourself, do I believe, as the founders of this great country believed, that I am the ultimate manifestation of the Creator's desire? After all, your fingerprint makes you different than the other 6 billion people on this planet. Do you believe your challenge is to fulfill that unique potential? Because don't ever forget, heroes begin human. Your life is weaved throughout the whole of society's fabric. It is intimately connected with the past and will be with the future. Mankind's history verifies this. There is no joke to be made out of that. You are entrusted with an inheritable responsibility, just as John Dickerson, a signer of the Constitution, eloquently laid out. Honor and justice and humanity call upon us to hold and to transmit to our posterity that liberty which we received from our ancestors. It is not our duty to leave wealth to our children, but it is our duty to leave liberty to them. No infamy, inequity, or cruelty can exceed our own if we, born and educated in a country of freedom, entitled to its blessings and knowing their value, pusillanimously deserting the post assigned to us by divine providence, surrender succeeding generations to a condition of wretchedness. Are you going to think and act today as if you believe the consequences of your choices will have an effect on this world not just 10 to 20 years from now, but 100, 200, or 300 years from now? Or are you going to surrender succeeding generations to a condition of wretchedness? Ask yourself the question the founder surely did. Will you do in your life what will live forever? Will you? God bless you. Thank you for having me.
Okay.